everybody, and welcome to the 61st episode of the Vassals of Kingsgrave Epic Linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread. My name's Bina 007, and I'll be your host today. And all of the rest of the people are Krakens, many of whom I met on my recent trip to Australia, which was an absolute delight. So let's start off on the West Coast with Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah, also known as Lady Weaver on the forums.
Dana, I don't know which part of Australia you're living in.
I'm pretty much 5 minutes away from Sarah.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Yeah. Team Dana on the forums.
Perfect. And then we have a new podcaster who I met in Adelaide, Lee.
Hi, I'm Lee, chaotic and usual on the forums.
Welcome. And then we have Michael, who I met in Melbourne, but isn't really from Melbourne. So, hey, Michael.
Sup, Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
Apparently an amazing Quidditch player, which I didn't realize was a thing. And then to podcast royalty, Valkyrus.
Hey, this is Duncan, also known as Valkyrus on the forums.
Okay, cool.
And he has no objections to being called podcast royalty. He's like, yeah, I know I am.
As soon as Bina said that, all I could think in my head is Wayne's World when they meet, you know, Alice Cooper.
We're not worthy.
Absolutely. So, Lee, because you're new on the podcast, we normally just ask people a little bit about how they got into the books, who their favourite characters are or character arcs. So, when did you start reading? When did you get into the books?
Probably considerably recently. I found it VOC first through a friend who doesn't participate anymore. And then I just quickly watched up until about season 6 or 5 on the show. And then I thought, I can't go any further. I have to read the books. And I read the books, done like a specific chapter rereads through rather than all the way through. And this is my first proper actual reread. VOC itself is where everything all started. I just, first of all, found the Worlds of Ice and Fire books and I could not be bothered reading this. So I just checked up on YouTube. And
you're not the only one, mate.
And once I checked everything on there, and the reason why I wanted to get into the actual forums itself was the dulcet tones of Duncan, just that golden voice. Absolutely. Yeah, I've even got like everything written down here because I'll probably forget, but like favorite character, I don't necessarily have a character. It's more chapters and books. Like Danny seemed the most interesting to me at the start. Tyrion and Davos in Clash, Sansa and Jaime in Storm. Sansa was really the only thing relatively interesting in Feast, and Dance not too much. It was just more the political intrigue throughout Marine that kind of interested me, but that lost me pretty quick because it just kept circling around just like Feast, really.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty familiar reaction. So you're Team Sansa, not Team Arya, which pleases me and obviously will please Nadia as well.
I wouldn't go as far as that. I'm Team Stark female.
Okay, that makes sense.
He's still Team Sansa. Let's be real.
It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both.
It's true, though. It is true. And it's kind of weird how sometimes it gets very oppositional in the fandom, I think, that you have to sort of identify with one or the other, which you're right. It's kind of strange, especially as Sansa becomes more and more Stark. You know, she becomes stronger. She becomes more interesting politically as a player, arguably better politically than any of the other Starks we've seen to date. So what are you
One
most...
thing I do have to point out is that my least favourite character, just by far and away, is Cersei in Feast. It is, like, Brienne is a drag in Feast, but Cersei just, please no.
But she's so crazy. It's great.
You know, it's great seeing the downfall, don't get me wrong, but just...
Yeah.
No, I really did struggle through that, to be honest.
I sort of agree. When I first read it, like, I had such a better impression of her. Like, she was so much more clever from the outside. But when you actually get in her head, you realize how much of it was just luck. And she actually isn't that crafty of a schemer as she thinks she is.
That's an interesting question for future podcasts, isn't it? Like, which is the character that once you got a POV, you were most disappointed or most impressed?
No, I can definitely say
there is one.
Because I'm exactly the same. I was so looking forward to get everything from Cersei's perspective, but then when it actually came, it was just, imagine how clever Tywin would think I am right now. It just really put me off.
There is one passage, though. I think it's when she's in the bed with Lady Meriwether, where she's describing, I won't spoil it, but it's just like this chilling description of her hatred for Robert, where she's describing his the heirs that never were. And it'll be interesting to get to that chapter because it's one of the most like vivid passages in the whole series. It's just chilling, the hatred she has for Robert.
So, Lee, are you reading the Winds of Winter spoiler chapters, or not spoiler, preview chapters even?
Yeah, I'm completely spoiled on everything so far, so there's no off limits. I'll try and obviously refrain from show talk, but...
Yeah, it's going to be interesting as we get into Feast Dance, which of the hosts have and haven't, because as you start getting into a lot of the Kraken stories, how much you know about Euron becomes really relevant into how you read some of those scenes, really gives it shade.
I'm actually really looking forward to the Feast Dance part of the reread, because I feel like, and we sort of talked about this at the Moot, that the first three books have been so analyzed because we've had them for so long, but I feel like because so much of like books 4 and 5 are up in the air, so many characters are in flux, states in flux, it's so much more fractured and incomplete. There's a lot more to talk about, I think, and a lot more to speculate about. And because so many people were frustrated with those chapters, I'm wondering if they haven't actually gone back to them for a reread. So knowing all the things we know now, we might sort of tease a few more things out that we didn't on the first go around.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm really looking forward to it. And I think I've not given Dance in particular a fair crack. So that will be my first proper reread. I've only ever done the Feast Dance character ones. And I think you're right, there'll be so much more to say. Hopefully
there's
so.
A lot of Feast Dance reread theories I want to rip apart.
that as well. That's always fun.
A lot of people are wrong.
I look forward to hearing your voice a lot more on podcasts in the future in that case, Michael. Cool. Okay, well, let's get on with the show. We're entering a kind of interesting period where we're really mixing up chapters from Feast, Dance and Storm of Swords at the moment. So we ended the last episode hosted by Casey with the last Arya chapter in A Storm of Swords, which took place between the 30th of January and 6th of February, 300 AL. In this episode, we're going to cover the prologue and Brienne 1 from A Feast for Crows, and the final Tyrion chapter, Tyrion 11 from A Storm of Swords. So these are all pretty meaty chapters. And the events take place on the 6th and 7th of February, 300. So on to the first chapter. I think it's going to be Michael who gives us a chapter summary. So after Arya 13 ends on February 6th, we jump forward 8 chapters to the prologue for A Feast for Crows. We'll pick the one and only, and it takes place on the same day. Over to you, Michael.
All right, so we're at Old Town. Pate is drinking cider at the Quill and Tankard in Old Town and is discussing rumours of dragons from incoming sailors with his friends. His novice companions, Rune and Melander, are more convinced the tales are real, while the acolytes Armin and Alaris are more sceptical. Armin outright disbelieves these claims, but Alaris thinks that the stories of three dragons and a girl might relate to Daenerys Targaryen, who is alive in exile somewhere in Essos. Alaris is half Dornish, half Summer Islander, student of the Citadel, nicknamed the Sphinx, who is celebrating winning the third link of his maester's chain. Pate reflects on his own prospects of becoming a maester. He has been at the Citadel for 5 years, but still remains a novice without any chain links. His real motive for being here tonight at the Quill and Tankard is to exchange a stolen Archmaester's iron key for a gold dragon with the mysterious person known as the Alchemist. Pate plans to use the coin to buy the maidenhead of a serving girl called Rosie, who he is attracted to and has dreams of marrying and travelling Westeros with. The group is interrupted by Lazy Leo Tyrell, who begins mocking Pate and friends, but eventually reveals that Archmaester Marwyn, called Marwyn the Mage, and distrusted by the Archmaester's conclave, also believes the rumours of Daenerys and the Three Dragons to be true, and that the return of dragons portends the return of magic to the world. As proof of this, he says that the once unlightable glass candles of the Citadel are now burning. As dawn approaches, the group departs, but Pate stays behind in hopes that the Alchemist will turn up. As he gives up and starts to head back to the Citadel, the Alchemist finally appears and the two make their deal. Pate exchanges his iron key, which can supposedly open any door in the Citadel, for the gold dragon, which Pate bites to test its authenticity. Pate asks what the man wants the key for, but is told that it is none of his concern. Pate examines his face, but sees only a stranger who identifies himself as no one. As Pate leaves, his vision starts to blur and he falls to the ground. Pate exclaims that he doesn't understand, to which the stranger sadly replies that he never will.
Nicely done. So much. I don't know where to begin on this chapter.
There is a lot in this chapter, yeah.
What is the first thing you want to talk about? Or I can jump
Maybe
in.
We should start with the easy ones. Does anyone not think that Alaris the Sphinx is Cirella?
I mean, I do, but I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that the first time I read it, I didn't.
Oh, I completely missed it.
I don't think you completely missed it. Get it on there.
What, Duncan, you don't think she is?
No, I don't think you could possibly have caught it on the first go round. It's such an abstract kind of little nugget that's in there. The fact that her name is Alaris written backwards.
Yeah, very tricksy on the part of George. That's definitely a Westeros.org reveal for me. Do you guys think...
Needed the internet, yeah.
What is her purpose? Is it just to attain knowledge, or does she have some wider plot? And does Doran know?
Doran says in the last chapter, Cirella is playing her game in Old Town, so I think he knows.
And so what do you think the purpose is? Just to infiltrate in general and get knowledge in general, or is there some wider plot?
I think if you look at the Sand Snakes, they're all really influenced by their father, and they all try and emulate him in some way. And so, like, who is it? Nymeria is a warrior, and Obara is a warrior, and Tyena is the poisoner. So I kind of imagine that Cirella is like, I'll be the maester, and that's just her deal.
Well, they've all been taught by their father to be fiercely loyal to Dawn. So I imagine whatever she's doing, it's done in the interest of Dawn, which makes me think that she wouldn't be a maester, because if she graduated to be a maester, then she'd have to go and be in service to another castle or another family and be loyal to them.
Oh, I imagine once she gets the chain, or even before that, she's going to be like, haha, I was a woman all along. Take that, you sexist pigs.
Like, maybe that's the point she's making, yeah, that a woman can graduate to be a maester and then she just shirks it, has all the knowledge, but then just goes off and does her own thing.
Yeah, and she could always just go train there, and then before she says her vows and actually becomes a full-blown maester, just is like, bye, and spirits herself back to Dawn and uses her training for Dawn.
Yeah.
And for her uncle.
Sorry, I don't think the title would be at all relevant to her. It just doesn't make sense. And just to interject, but like one thing that I do find interesting is that she's over there and she's with Marwyn too, but with Danny over in Meereen and sending Quentin that way too. I just wonder if there's any correlation between those that would be a reason for her to go there, or it's just completely off her own whim.
Yeah, good question.
I think she's staying in Old Town. She's not going over with Marwyn. Is that...
Not necessarily, just as in she's learning from Marwyn, just having to find herself along there neatly about his whole thoughts with dragons and whatnot. It's kind of loose, or a very loose thread, but it could possibly be just putting it out there. Because I don't think she'll go back or do anything else with Marwyn now that he's left anyway. I don't think anyone else at the Citadel, at least for the short term.
It seems weird to put her in there, to make such a kind of clever, tricksy point with it and not have her... have a major plot point later on. Like at some point, George needs to pick up that thread.
Yeah, and that's why I found it a strange prologue, because the other prologues all have a fairly involved, or they offer sort of crucial plot information for that particular book. So you look at Beyond the Wall, the first emergence of the others, and then the first introduction of Stannis and all the crew on Dragonstone, and then the attacker, the Battle of the Fist of the First Man. Like, those are all very important events for those particular books, whereas none of the stuff that occurs in this prologue has much of a bearing on A Feast for Crows. We get these two little intrigues about, you know, possibly one of the Sand Snakes is there undercover, and possibly one of the Faceless Men is up to some mischief, but it's pretty tiny bits of information. Like the prologue itself, none of the characters have much of a role in the rest of the book, or even book five.
I felt it would have been far more appropriate as a prologue for Dance. And if you imagine George writing this originally as one massive book, then the themes of dragons, what's up with Danny, hinting at Miriam Azdura and the Marwyn theme, it all feels far more catered to a book that's going to spend a lot of time with Danny and just reporting back on what people are thinking of what she's up to. So it just feels it's been a little bit maybe misedited in terms of where it's been put in the final cut.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as a chapter. I liked the characters and I liked getting this new city and this new location, but it does feel like a bit of an early warning sign in terms of Martin just wanting to explore the world, even if it doesn't necessarily have a bearing on his core plot. He wants to go wide rather than deep. and everything kind of slows down a bit.
And yet stuff happens. Yeah, you know, people die, but it's just not as purposeful. It's not as meaningful. If you think of the previous prologues, it was always... And also the previous prologues always felt like self-contained short stories, which this one doesn't.
Like, what does Pate's death really mean to the characters? The death of the characters in the first three prologues were sort of important, or they were meaningful, but here it seems a bit, it's just some poor guy who's deluded and falls in love and gets tricked by some sinister entity that we never see again.
I do think that I think this is fitting it being in Feast, because this directly correlates to Sam 5 as well. Once Sam, I know that's a bit further down the track, but these two in particular, it being in the same book, I think makes sense. Because if you had this as the prologue as Dance and then having Sam already met Marwyn, that one probably doesn't fit as well. It does beg to question as well as whether or not it was completely necessary to split this up into two, but I just found it really weird that, I just lost my train of thought.
All the way in which it was split up with two, like the controversy of having it split by characters rather than linearly. So why should it not have been just Feast, Dance Part 1 and 2 and just carried all three? Sorry, Sarah.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say there are at least some Aria chapters in Feast, so it does sort of make sense having this chapter being the prologue for it. It's not a great fit, but you do have the alchemist who, at least in my mind, is a faceless man. So it does sort of fit with her storyline. And like Lee was saying, it does with all of the Maester stuff fit with Sam's as well. It's not a perfect fit, but...
Yeah. So do any of you think that it's Jack and Hagar rather than just a generic faceless man?
Oh, me. I do. because the physical description matches to what Arya describes him in Harrenhal. I think he has full cheeks, a hooked nose, a scar on his right cheekbone, and curly black hair. So, yes, I think it is the man that once identified himself as Jack and Hagar.
Yeah, I think it's one of those theories that it's just accepted as true. It just fits that description so like perfectly.
Forever. Lee, do you want to jump in?
It's hard to dispute against it, that it is Jacken.
Agree. So what does he want with Waldegrave's key?
To get into the Citadel, of course.
But to do what, specifically? to kill someone, presumably. I mean, he's a faceless man. That's what he does. Or does he want a candle?
I thought he might want, because they emphasize the dragonglass candle so much in this chapter, that... It would make sense if that's what they're going for.
It could just be like an information gathering mission. Like he's just like a sleeper agent. He just sits there, gets the information he needs, feeds it back to the faceless men. I'm sure they have people like that all over the world. But there is a passage in book 5, I think, where Tyrion refers to a book that's locked in the libraries of the Citadel that explains how you can kill a dragon. I think it was written by Septon Barth, who's often referred to as like a sorcerer. So some people have speculated that that's the purpose, that the faceless men have become aware that there are dragons in the world again, and they've started gathering information on how to potentially neutralize that threat, because the Bravosi are obviously anti-dragon, being former slaves of the Valyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The thing about the faceless men and their missions that we learn in Arya's chapters is that killing innocent civilians as collateral damage is unacceptable. So the fact that Pate is killed to facilitate this suggests to me either that he's a rogue agent or this is more than just, mere assassination. So it's something important.
Can you hire the faceless men for just random espionage? Like, or do they just do that for themselves? Like, can you only hire them to kill people, or can you just hire them for general mischief?
I think it's just to kill people.
For espionage. But I think because they're such a death cult and like that's their thing, that it would just be for killing people.
Okay.
It would be great if you could hire them for random spy missions. You can be like, I need to know this. Go. Thanks. But...
Yeah, that's a good point. Why does he actually kill Pate? Because Pate is obviously not going to be someone that, like, who would order a hit against Pate? And besides, you've got the key. Why do you need to kill him?
Yeah, exactly.
What if he's stealing his face because that way he can get in, and then the Maester, the Archmaester he's taking care of, Archmaester Walgrave, he has dementia anyway and doesn't call him by the correct name. So if he goes there, the Maester won't really realize that it's not the same person if he acts differently.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, definitely suggests sleeper agent status, because he's there when Sam meets him in the final Sam chapter. That's the punchline.
And it is, I think you're right, Sarah, that it is connected to Arya's storyline, because it's almost like we're seeing the face, one of Arya's missions, from her victim's point of view. And he even does the thing where he bites the coin, and that ends up being his downfall. Like, he doesn't realize it's been poisoned, but Arya, we find out that information later, that Arya uses that technique. So you're sort of getting two sides of an assassination. I think there are definitely a few little threads that run through this prologue that connect to the rest of the book, but they're much more subtle, I think, than the previous prologues.
So, Marwyn the Mage, go. What is he up to? Whose interests does he serve? God. What is his relationship with Miri Mazdor? Well, I guess we know that a little bit, but what has he learned in Essos?
Magic.
And what is Lord
Black magic.
And what is Lord Roderick Harlow doing reading his Book of Lost Books up with the Krakens? There are theories that he's going to use some occult knowledge to overturn the sort of Euron Vic Horn thing. What's Marwyn's endgame? Whose interest does he serve? Is it still the Citadel? Because now he's doing black magic. That's basically contrary to their philosophy.
I don't know. I think, like, knowledge is knowledge. It's kind of like, just because they're skeptical of it, it doesn't mean it's not a worthy area of investigation. That doesn't mean he's betraying the Maesters by investigating the occult. Like, I think he would still, he seems to be on the Maester's side or acting on behalf of the Citadel. He just doesn't necessarily play by their bureaucracy all of the time.
But they would see him as not acting on their sides in the same way as Qyburn, right? So I find it amazing that it's such common knowledge that he's using the candle. Like, it feels like with Denethor and the Palantir, that everyone knows that he sits in this room at the top of Minas Tirith and you see this weird light coming out. It's very Tolkien to me. But I'm just amazed it's so open as knowledge.
The description of that being
It might just be Lazy Leo is the one who has it, so I don't know if it's like common knowledge at this point. It's just, the glass candles are burning, but not that they're being used for anything.
But the fact that they're burning just seems impossible, because that the description of that as being the final test of the Maester to accept the limits of their knowledge. It reminds me a bit of like the Star Trek Kobayashi Maru thing. Like, you have to accept failure. But you know, Marwyn's kind of like Kirk. Like, he's hacked the system somehow and made it possible. But I guess it's just part of that idea of magic returning to the world, and what we thought was true is no longer true.
I'm very pleased we got a Tolkien and Trek reference in the same sort of train of thought. That makes me happy.
Well, the body of knowledge that we assume was true, or the way we thought we could verify that knowledge, is no longer as stable as we thought it was. Like, the world is changing somehow.
Any more Marwyn the Mage thoughts, or any other thoughts on this chapter in general? Lee, did you have any notes we haven't covered yet?
The only thing that I can see, for going back to Jaqen for a sec, is that the thought that he's there to find the book and to how to kill dragons and whatnot. I find that I don't quite believe that, because I think that if the Citadel really believed any of that kind of stuff, that they would have already tried to hire someone already. Although it doesn't, that wouldn't necessarily make sense, I suppose, considering that they don't believe any of that is actually happening. But for Marwyn, I honestly think he's there for himself. I don't think he's there for the Citadel, to be honest, or otherwise that correlates with going back to Jaqen as well, that the Maesters don't really believe any of this is, or they're just ignorant to it more than anything.
You go, Ben.
But I just sort of feel that if the Maesters are ignorant to it, if they knew about it, they would be prejudicially hostile, because they just associate all magic with dragons, and, you know, they just don't think it should exist in the world. So, yeah, I think he's gone rogue. I'm not sure to what end. I'd love to know what his background is genealogically, and whether he might have any sort of hidden allegiances we don't know about yet.
I'm interested to see where this story goes now that Sam is going to be training at Old Town and seems to be in contact with Pate. Like, Pate's going to be a character in his story, and Sorella presumably is going to be a character in his story as well. So we're probably going to see what happens in their storylines. And also, I guess the Ironborn and Euron's impending invasion is going to happen as well too. But I was wondering, if Pate is going to be talking with Sam, is he going to learn about the White Walkers, that they're actually returned? And will that maybe change his opinion on what to be done with the dragons? Like, if his mission is to destroy the dragons, will knowing that the White Walkers have returned maybe change his opinion on that? Will this information, you know, sort of upend the plans of the Faceless Men?
One would hope so. That would be so amazing. Faceless Men on team, yeah.
Team dragons.
Yeah, well.
That'd be a good ally, yeah. Yeah.
Would they follow it? Because they do respect death so much, but then with the White Walkers, they bring people back from the dead, but not back like ice zombies. So would they go against it, or would they fall in line with the others and think of them as being like,
it's like a perversion
of death. I want to say gods, but not really gods, but like,
it's like the White Walkers are stealing death from death or something like that.
Yeah.
It would be really eloquent.
Like, whether the White Walkers are like death personified or something. Like a living embodiment of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure where they'd side.
Does anyone else believe that Euron is the champion of the White Walkers or others?
Yes.
He definitely sees himself as it. I don't know if the White Walkers necessarily think the same, if it's reciprocal, or if he just imagines it's going to be reciprocal.
I thought it might be the opposite, like that he's being used as an instrument by the Dark Forces, but he just sees himself as this megalomaniac who just wants to rule everything, but he's actually being used to tear everything down and, I don't know, bring dark magic back.
I feel that he's being used, definitely.
Yeah.
I feel like he's got more of a point to prove. Knowing that in Tiwau, hearing that what Bloodraven tried to connect to him as well, that just absolutely blew my mind. And just there's so many different things you can draw from that. It's so many different conclusions that that got me into just like research overload, just trying to figure out what exactly could become of that.
Well, I sort of had a crazy theory that he had some connection, Euron had a connection to the Church of Starry Wisdom, which doesn't actually appear in the novels, but it's referenced a few times in the World of Ice and Fire. And it's like the religion that's centered around the oily black stones that just keep popping up all over Westeros and Essos. It's the thing that the Seastone Chair is made of, just this ancient, almost alien rock that appears that's connected to Cthulhu and all that. So I don't even know if he's on the White Walker side or what side he's on, if it's this third side that we hadn't even considered, the sort of the merman kind of, you know, side, to storm god side. But yeah, that's probably a bit too tangential. Like, that information hasn't been discussed in the books, so it's probably just maybe an interesting part of the lore that maybe doesn't actually participate in this story. But that's probably a bit far out there.
anything
maybe
else
we should get back to the any thoughts on the characters of like Pate or anything?
Leo seems like an ass. Pate seems really sad. Just pathetic.
Yeah.
I kind of felt sorry for him. Like, he is really deluded and he's a bit creepy around Rosie, but he seemed kind of good natured and he sort of gets along with the other acolytes, and I don't know, I felt sorry for him. Like, he's so deluded.
He's such a loser, isn't he? He's just never gonna make a chain and he's not gonna get laid and I don't know.
Which is a theme. Like, in the Martin's text, like, you sort of see it, I guess, with Chet, who's a way worse character. But you see a lot of characters like this, just these kind of weak, stupid, deluded characters, who just get preyed upon by the strong. It's just a kind of ruthless world. But I appreciate that Martin often shows compassion for these characters. Like, a character like Pate, he didn't even have to bring him up. Like, he's just a nothing character. But even this sort of bit character, you kind of feel bad for and you feel something for. And you feel like he has a story and he had hopes and dreams and he was a bit of a loser, but there was something he wanted to pursue. And there was like a moral thing that he was wrestling with. He didn't want to betray the Citadel. He wanted to leave because he felt like a loser, but he found himself walking back to it at the end of the night. And I don't know, there was some little nugget of an interesting story there that got cut off at its heels.
All he wanted was that donkey.
Yeah.
And
just
Rosie.
The simple life. Wanted to be a barber and have a nice girl by his side, but no. Not for you, Pate. You die in the gutter.
There's a bit of food porn, as there usually is, and it's used to display some classism. So when a lazy Leo is mocking that sort of group, he's like, "Oh, I had some suckling pig tonight with cherry sauce stuffed with walnuts. What did you guys have?" And then I think Molander is like, "Fuck you, we had a piece of mutton." And then you have, who is it, Alaris, who's drinking these expensive summer wines, and he's kind of conspicuous because of that. More classism, which is an interesting place for it because this is the Citadel, which is supposedly classless.
And you get a bit of a contrast with that with the Pate the Pig Boy story, which is about this commoner who's always besting knights and betting royal ladies and things like that. But in the context of the story, you see that Pate has to hold his tongue because he knows that Lazy Leo has connections and all that. So it's like by making fairy tale stories out of these out of the poor person, you know, getting ahead, you sort of protect the class structure in a way.
Spotted Pate the Pig Boy. With that story, it actually makes me think of the Faceless Man and him taking over Pate's body and then putting on his face, whether that has happened in the past because he was meant to be a stupid person and then is able to outwit everyone else, or whether he's just faking it. But also...
Pate the Pig Boy was a faceless man. That's a good theory.
Yes.
Nice.
Headcanon. No, but as well, I recently read The Piebald Prince by Robin Hobb, and I'm just like, oh, it's so similar. It's so similar. But yeah, not really, but sorry. Okay, I'll be quiet now.
Do you think in the future, when all is said and done, we might get a story about Pate the Pig Boy who outwitted the Citadel based on what happens here?
He beat the maesters.
maybe. Yeah. Brings down the Citadel. Pate the Big Boy.
I've got to be honest. I wouldn't want to hear too much about Pate being called Poor Crescent as well. It'd be fun to know more about the Citadel, but hopefully we get more of that in Winds. But Pate, there's only so much you can take of that poor kid.
Well, now that he's faceless Pate, I think he'll be a bit more interesting.
Yeah, man.
Now that he isn't Pate at all. Savage. You guys are so harsh.
I have a random point that I picked up on this chapter.
Go for it.
So Alaris actually use the line of Lannister to refer to Tywin in this chapter. And that's when she's talking about how it was Prince Rhaegar's young son, Aegon, whose head was dashed against the wall by the line of Lannister's brave men. And previously in A Game of Thrones, that's only been used to refer to Jaime. And that happened twice in the first book and hasn't happened since. And it was in Jon's first chapter when he sees them for the first time. He says, "They call him the Lion of Lannister to his face and whisper the Kingslayer behind his back." And at the Hound's Tourney, and that one's an Eddard chapter, and that one's a long quote, but... So, yeah. Do you think that it's a moniker that's passed down through Lannisters, like the Sword of the Morning is to the Danes? Or do you think it's just...
Oh, clever, yeah. Maybe.
Just George.
Sounds like an informal nickname that the Lannisters would encourage... But yeah, it could be hereditary, because when you actually listen to Mace Tyrell and all the many, many titles that he has, I'm sure the Lannisters want a few superfluous titles for themselves as well.
One of the titles is like the Shield of the West or something, I remember. One final point, they mentioned dragons being sighted at various points in the world, and most of them are the dragons that we see with Dany, like one in Carth and Meereen and things like that. But they also mention Ashai. The dragons have been seen in Ashai. And I think in book one, when Bran's having one of his dreams, he sees dragons stirring in Ashai. So I was just wondering, there may be more than three dragons in the world, which could come into play later.
Oh my goodness. That blows my mind.
We're only going to see these three dragons. To add more now would kind of just be lame and
unless they're ice dragons.
No, ice, that's even
ice
lamer.
Dragons are cool.
That's the worst idea ever. I'm not a fan of ice dragons.
Ice dragon being controlled by a Stark, that'd be cool.
Oh god,
not gonna happen.
I really hope
my
not.
Eyes are rolling into the back of my head.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is now a good point to move to the next chapter. Ice dragons just killed it for me.
So what are you saying, you don't want dragons to kill everyone and rule the world?
No. I actually think they're narratively problematic because they're such a weapon of mass destruction. They just unbalance the narrative in some way.
Agree. That's why I hate guns in any story. It's so cheap.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll lead to like a civil war. Not a civil war, a cold war, where neither you have ice dragons and fire dragons and neither can attack because it'll be mutually assured destruction.
And like Braavos is the Cuban Missile Crisis location.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay. So after the prologue from A Feast for Crows, we jump forward just four chapters to Brienne 1, which takes place on the same day. A little bit of context. At this point, Brienne is just 20 years old, which was surprising to me. And Podrick Payne is around 13 or 14. And I believe it's Duncan with a chapter summary.
Yes. Okay, so Brienne is traveling to Duskendale, seeking the whereabouts of Sansa, as she was charged to by Jaime Lannister. Having found few leads in King's Landing, Brienne is asking nearly everyone she comes across if they have seen a maid of 3 and 10 with blue eyes and auburn hair. Upon the road beyond Rosby, she comes upon a camp with two hedge knights who offer to share their meal. The next day, one of them recognizes her as the murderess of King Renly, but Brienne swears by the Seven that she is innocent of that crime, and the hedge knights agree to travel with her to Duskendale. After passing a large group of poor fellows, which are lowly holy men bound for King's Landing, bearing the bones of Septons killed around the Riverlands, they catch up to a merchant guarded by a couple of men and another hedge knight named Sir Shadrick. Joining forces along the dangerous road, Sir Shadrick tells Brienne in private that he knows that the maid she seeks is Sansa Stark, and that she seeks is Sansa Stark, and that he seeks her as well, but for a purse of gold offered by Varys. Brienne is disturbed by the fact that the knight knew whom she was speaking of when she repeated Sansa's description to the merchant's group. When the party stops at an inn for the night, Brienne slips off on her own, swearing to herself that she will not fail Jaime, having already failed King Renly and Lady Catelyn. So this is the first of many Brienne chapters.
Have you seen my sister?
Which the readers are often split on.
Sorry. I didn't realize she had 8 chapters. I thought it was just 4. But
no,
yeah.
And it feels like about 16, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious.
No comment. I like it.
A lot of people find these chapters pretty frustrating for a few different reasons. One is that we kind of know that she's searching for someone she's never going to find. Like, it's okay that she's searching for Sansa, but because we get the Sansa chapters, we know that she's nowhere near her. So it feels like a bit of a doomed quest. So it's difficult to invest in. And a bit like we were talking about with Pate, her chapters often have very little bearing on the main plot. It's more of a world-building exercise and a character development exercise, which is important too. But it feels sort of removed from the events up until the very end where she meets up with Lady Stoneheart. But everything before that feels a bit sort of pointless.
Can you imagine if you had had Brienne and Quentin, so they'd have split Feast Dance chronologically? You'd have both of them just on this like fairly pointless, futile mission, wandering around.
I liked Brienne's chapters more than Quentin's, to be fair, because at least it's Westeros.
Yeah, this
and
is
we
true.
Know Brienne.
Yeah, and I like Brienne. I liked her journey, like her internal journey.
I was so frustrated when Brienne's going through the list of places that Sansa might have gone to, and she totally forgets Lysa, and she comes back to her in the next chapter. But it's like, oh, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm. Not the brightest.
Yeah, I love these chapters on a second reread. But the first, yeah. They're really good world building. I enjoy that stuff now that we're in this long wait. That's fun.
It reminds me a lot of Duncan Egg. Like, it has that feel of just a lot of sort of minor characters and just on the road and meeting lots of people, staying in
Hedge
inns,
Knight.
Going on adventures. There doesn't feel the sense of immediacy and they're like really intense danger and high stakes at the rest of the series. It feels like you could take these chapters out and just make a little novella out of them.
Yeah, and that's probably what you should
have done. You could easily cut all these chapters.
Well, not all of them. You could have had, like, in past books, we've had this
sorry,
where he
like,
has,
not all, yeah.
You have a Dany chapter, which covers about 4 months, and you kind of struggle with a linear reread as to where to put it. And I feel Brienne could have really benefited from that, just a compendium chapter that just brought you up to speed on where she was, and then get into the sort of Lady Stoneheart stuff. This is very frustrating.
Yeah. They feel like...
Not all the chapters, but definitely could have been condensed. No, you're right. Definitely could have been condensed significantly too. I do like the world building, but this is just too much.
Yeah, they definitely feel like the chapters that have been put in there once he decided to split the book into, or once he decided to not do the 5-year gap, they do feel a bit fillerish and they lack the sort of the narrative drive, sort of driving importance forward,
yeah,
but they sort of lack the influence on the rest of the story. But I think I didn't mind them. They are frustrating, but I guess they have more like thematic importance from Martin's point of view. Like they don't necessarily have a lot of plot influence, but he's sort of trying to show something about the world that not many fantasy books will show, which is the kind of the post-war society and the reconstruction and the sense of collapse and hopelessness that is engendered after a war.
Which is fine, but I feel you get a lot of that from the Arya and the Hound chapters, the breakdown of society, the rising crime, the sort of the poverty, the inability to get food because everything's been disrupted. I just don't think you need Brienne chapters to rehash that.
That's true, but I mean, so
much extra that we needed to see in this post stage.
That's true, but I think to me the Arya and the Hound chapters are really hopeless, and it's this downward spiral where I think, at least with Brienne, there's a sense that she does have hope, and she's not blind to the horror that's happening in the Riverlands, but she's actively trying to restore order or trying to do good. She's like a good sort of check against the evil in the world. That for as many people that are trying to do ill in this world, there's people like Brienne out there who have a good heart and are trying to sort of fight against that. So I guess they're a bit more hopeful for me in that regard. Although you could argue towards the later chapters, she too is losing hope and becoming a broken man or woman.
Something in favor of this chapter and a couple of Brienne chapters that I might as well bring up is we get to be introduced to a couple of important characters that will be important later on. So how many people spotted the High Sparrow in this chapter?
I did.
Huh?
Yeah, ooh, the High Sparrow. He has like a crystal around his neck and he's going past with all of the people singing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so he's riding on that convoy or whatever. And again, his physical description matches how Cersei will describe him a couple of things later.
Mm-hmm. And how he talks as well about the people and is trying to influence them also matches quite well with the High Sparrow, and he calls them his sparrows. So, yeah.
Who spotted... Oh, yeah, you go.
No, you go.
I was going to say, we also get to see Ser Shadrique, who will be making his way to the Vale later.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. How many of you think Shadrique the Mouse is going to be important in Teeware with Elaine? Because he knows what's up with that, right?
Absolutely. If you go by that Winds of Winter chapter, where he gets really close to her and is like, oh, what are the chances of a hedge like me getting a bag of gold? I'm like, he knows what's up.
Indeed. So to that extent, maybe we are a bit harsh on George because he is laying the groundwork for future interesting stuff.
I do think he does pose some imminent danger, but let's be honest, he's the whole thing was that, wasn't it Varys who's put out the thing to get Lady Sansa, and what's he going to do, carry her down the Vale?
Yep, basically.
he does meet up with some other people as well, though.
I assume Varys was issuing the bounty on Cersei's behalf, but Shadrique might not know that Cersei's been in prison and that her power's been sapped and that Varys has fled the capital, so there might not be anyone to go back to collect the bounty, which could change his actions once he realizes that.
I think once you get into the Vale, it's a bit isolated, so he probably doesn't know about that message. Yeah, that Cersei's been imprisoned, Varys is gone, all that. I do think when he starts to abduct Sansa, he's not going to get very far. There are a lot of people around there.
I feel like this is going to be another one of those cliffhanger endings to what there was a lot of Brienne and Feast Dance.
Final person that you might have missed. Did anyone spot Podrick in this chapter?
Multiple times, yes.
Yep.
I didn't realize who he was. Yeah, I wrote it down. Like, who is this guy? Is he doing something for the Sparrows? And then only afterwards, when I read the Tower of the Hand, I was like, oh, that's Podrick. Just shows how long it's been since I've reread these chapters.
Poor Pod, just hanging around like a little stalker. I have to say, because I've read ahead a little bit on Brienne, and it's such a lovely moment when they find each other. Like, oh, fantastic.
It is funny how, like, we keep having to remind ourselves that these characters all have restricted vision. So, like, when Pate sees Jaqen, we recognize him, but he doesn't. And the same with Brienne. Like, we know this character so well, but to Brienne, it's just a young kid on a horse.
Yes, but honestly, for George, marrying Pod's and Brienne's stories works very well, because otherwise you have someone off looking for Sansa who has never actually met her and is going based off descriptions. If it's from Jaime, it's like a year and a half old.
The descriptions that I keep remembering after listening to the audiobooks as well as Roy Dotrice. Have you seen my sister? A maid of 3 and 10 and auburn hair. Oh, goodness, I just cannot get that out.
It's
everyone is Welsh
in
his reading.
I know, he's done more disservice to the Welsh accent than anyone.
Everyone is Welsh except for the Ironborn, who are Australian.
Yeah.
I have a note for Brienne, because I think in most of her chapters we don't see her point of view of how she's being described by other people and how she feels being so often mistaken for being a man. And in this chapter we have how she feels about it, that she feels freakish in her own body, and like a lot of the way of how she feels focuses on how tall she is. And it's never actually written in the books how tall she is, but George has done an interview, and in it he said that Brienne's likely six foot six or under, so that's 198 centimeters or less, but she's still well over 6 foot tall, but not close to 7. And that she's taller than Renly and Jaime, and significantly heavier than either, but nowhere near the size of Gregor Clegane, who is the true giant in the series. So she is massively tall, and yeah, I think I feel bad for her because I'm really tall as well and nowhere near as tall as she is. And I can really, really relate to her character and how she feels in her body. So, and being a tall person growing up, you don't necessarily see a lot of characters who are female and very tall. It's quite often, if you're reading like fantasy for younger characters, even if it does have a female protagonist, they are very often short or shorter, not very tall. So
that's a really good point.
So Brienne speaks to me.
And you get a sense of the constant verbal cuts she endures as she's making her way through this world, not just because she's tall, but because she's dressed as a soldier or a knight. She's taking on a masculine role as a female, and that upsets a lot of passerbys. Like, there's little comments, people talking under their breath. One guy's like, look at this, you know, get a load of that, or something like that. And the hedge knights are like, we've got to protect you, my lady. The road is no place for a helpless maid, even though she's like double the size of them and could cut them in two with one blow. But it reminded me a bit of Tyrion, just the sort of constant snide remarks that he endures, just this kind of death by a thousand cuts that kind of wears him down.
But what's amazing about Brienne, or what you admire even more about her once you get the POV chapters, is that she hasn't allowed herself to become cynical as a consequence. If you have endured a life to 20 years old now, where every single day you're getting very dismissive and pejorative comments about you, the fact that she remains basically one of the most honourable, arguably naive but optimistic and kind of wholesome characters in these books is something of a miracle.
Yeah, but I think she's had some more positive figures in her life. Like, her father genuinely does seem pretty understanding and pretty loving towards her. And also Renly seems to have played a pretty big role in her life, even though all the men around her at the camps treated her horribly. She could always trust in Renly to respect her true worth and bolster her confidence. And that's why she loves him.
Yeah, definitely. But as well, with Renly, I think with Brienne's attachment to Renly, it's more that he showed her kindness when so many people her own age would not have. None of her peers did, and they all teased her and mocked her, whereas he was the only person who really showed her any sense of kindness and wasn't a family member or someone from her castle and where she lived. So,
yeah, good point.
Stand up guy, Renly. Stand up guy.
Yeah. Well, not actually. I think Renly's a piece of shit, but this one act he did was very nice.
Very nice. But I think going against what a lot of people think about someone and helping them, though, especially at a younger age, is quite hard to do. So it does show some good character in him, in that he's willing to do that.
I sort of feel with Renly, we haven't seen enough of him before he dies to really make that sort of judgment. But to me, he just comes across as quite superficial, quite in love with himself, and he does do this one good thing, but probably more because it tickles his sense of fun, because it's so unusual, rather than, I mean, maybe there's some genuine kindness in there, but I think it's more for novelty and amusement than anything else. You know, we should be careful about reading that relationship from Brienne's very romantic view of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. He's good at schmoozing the crowd, I guess.
And Renly, as a prince, you know, there's not like he could do whatever he wants and no one's going to say, you can't do that. Whereas someone like Jon Snow, who shows kindness to Sam in a very similar situation, I have a lot more respect for Jon Snow for doing something like that. Because he's, as we know, just a bastard.
Agree. Okay, anything else on the chapter or should we move on to the final one? I know,
this will play a bigger role in later chapters, but I think it'd be interesting to look at the way that religion plays a role in A Feast for Crows. The fact that a lot of the small folk have become disenfranchised with the current ruling class because of the complete destabilization of the Riverlands that their war has caused, this Game of Thrones that they've played out has ruined their lives, and now they've started flocking to this religious cause. And the High Sparrow is able to galvanize the small folk, this completely ignored underclass, to great effect. I think that's an interesting theme, the way that the sort of insidious or the darker side that religion can have in terms of becoming an authoritarian role in society. But I also think Martin counterbalances that a bit in sort of a later chapter when Brienne arrives at the Quiet Isle. So I won't talk too much about it now because it's coming up later, but he offers a sort of a tempered version of like the sense of hope and the sense of like peace that religion can also provide for people.
That is something that I appreciate in A Feast Dance, is these various factions who you initially dismissed as sort of like furniture, they start to take shape and have their own agendas. So yeah, the religion, the small folk, even the maesters from last chapter, they're all sort of being established as, yeah, having their own deal, which makes the story more interesting.
That was a big thing I felt when I first read A Feast for Crows. So many of the main really powerful characters from A Storm of Swords had died in these, you know, big explosions of violence and glory and all that. And it was almost like none of the main characters were left. I mean, part of that was because he shifted a few of them to A Dance of Dragons. But A Feast for Crows really feels like a collection of secondary characters trying to rebuild the world or make sense of the world and not knowing what to do outside of the shadows of these great figures like Tywin Lannister and Robb Stark and all that, and I guess the Tullys as well. So it's almost like the characters from the margins have moved into the center, not just POV characters, but also people like the small folk and religious factions as well. It's like the power structure is being reconfigured in Westeros.
I think that's a really good way of putting it, very articulate. So after Brienne 1 from A Feast for Crows, we jump back 9 chapters to Tyrion 11, which is the final Tyrion chapter from A Storm of Swords. This takes place the next day on February the 7th AL, and at this point for context, Tyrion is 27 years old and Tywin is 58. And I believe it is Lee with his first ever chapter summary.
Thank you very much. Excuse me if it is a little bit long. There's just so much in this chapter.
Yeah, I think if there was a chapter that deserved a long summary, it's this one, so don't worry.
Yeah, I even tried to just really just take it down, but I couldn't. There's just too much good stuff in here. All right. Upon hearing noises outside of his cell, Tyrion is resigned that his time has come. The door opens and a gaunt, short-haired Jaime appears, brandishing his newly formed stump. The handless and the noseless Lannister boys, Tyrion remarks, bursting out in laughter. Jaime informs Tyrion that Varys, whom drugged the guards with sweet sleep, is waiting for him back at the stairs. He tells Tyrion he's saving him as a debt he feels he owes. Tyrion presses on this strange tone and gets Jaime to reveal Tysha was not a whore, but the crafter's daughter she appeared to be. Tywin made Jaime tell the lie, claiming Tyrion needed a sharp lesson to learn from. A furious Tyrion refuses anything more from Jaime and swears the Lannister oath on him, Cersei, and Tywin. We hear Tyrion reveal that it was Joffrey who tried to get Bran killed, and a spiteful lie to Jaime that he killed his vile son. We also get the ever-fun phrase we hear Jaime think throughout what seems like forever in Feast of, Cersei has been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy for all I know. Jaime turns and walks away. Tyrion thinks of calling him but remembers Tysha and remains silent. Tyrion meets up with Varys, who leads him through the passages until reaching a hallway where a mosaic of a three-headed dragon lie on the floor, hitting him of the place Shay described. Varys confirming they're below the Tower of the Hand, Tyrion asks with a not-so-convincing protest from Varys on how to get there. After making his way up an arduous climb of 230 rungs, Tyrion reaches the top and finds himself hearing two of Tywin's guards, Lester and Lum, discussing his impending execution. He moves to the Hand's bedchamber through a secret passage and is startled by the sound of Shae's voice, seeing her with Tywin's chains of gold linked hands. And this is something I really, really has stuck with me, and a testament to George's writing. It is these little things that it's still, for me, sad to this day. And Tyrion slid a hand under his father's chain and twisted, the links tightening, digging into her neck. The hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm, he said. He gave cold hands another twist as the warm ones beat away his tears. Tyrion takes a crossbow from the wall down, intended for Lum, but makes his way to the Privy Tower where he knew he'd find Tywin. Seemingly unconcerned of his presence, he tells Tyrion he is meant for the wall, though Tyrion only wants to ask one question, what he did with Tysha. Unimpressed with his answer of, wherever whores go, Tyrion shoots a very perceptive Tywin who exclaims, you shot me! With boughs loosening, Tywin dies. The stink that filled the privy gave ample evidence that the oft-repeated jape about his father was just another lie. Lord Tywin Lannister did not, in the end, shit gold.
Nicely done.
All right.
Where do we begin?
I love this chapter so much.
I know. It's one of the all-time best.
It's weird. I was so happy afterwards. I, like, went out to Mum and talked her ear off about this chapter, and she's like, yep, okay, Sarah, whatever. Okay, uh-huh. Yeah. Best chapter.
I remember feeling my eyebrows rise up as Tyrion shot Tywin. I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, that's my distinct memory.
I just love him saying, you shot me. Well,
I always kind of imagine it in my head as a kind of like Hercule Poirot end of movie chapter, where you just suddenly get this massive info dump. You finally get confirmed why Shae turned, how Bran was attacked, how Joff was killed. It's like, whoa, I can't cope with this information. And then Tywin gets killed and it's like, oh, this is radical.
It's such a roller coaster of emotions, because you get excited at the prospect that Tyrion's going to be rescued and you have this loving moment between the brothers, but then you get this horrible reversal of fortune and this belated betrayal in the form of Jaime revealing what happened with Tysha, which is such a huge traumatic part of Tyrion's psychology and in his memory throughout the book. And then it almost becomes like a horror story as he's going through these corridors and this torture chamber. And then at the end, it's like he kills his father, the thing he's been like dreaming about the entire books. And it's just, it's so much happens. It's like you say, Binner, it's almost overwhelming, the information and the events that are happening. You almost feel like, how do you even top this? I think that's probably why a lot of people were let down by book four. It's like, how do you live up to this? It's just so explosive. It just completely upends the game.
Yeah,
I think this is like a giant culmination of storm and clash just put into one chapter. Not necessarily from the story perspective, but in terms of just how efficient that he was in this chapter, which says it in the two books, well, first three books, really. It is his most efficient chapter, and so much just happened. I think it's like 11 or 12 pages. And you think about all that, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I was surprised how short the interactions were. Like Jaime and Tyrion talking wasn't that long, Tyrion and Tywin's final conversation, it just seemed to end so quickly. Like he was probably so many more things he wanted to ask him, but he just couldn't. He just had to kill him. He couldn't hold the arrow back any further. But also, as you say, it's a complete culmination of so much that happens. It's like you didn't need a lot of space. All the pieces were there. You just have to put them in motion.
But it does.
People
just
need to die. That's all.
It just brings about how tight the writing is. By the end of Storm of Swords, he's really at his peak. And then you contrast that with a Brienne chapter, and you just think of the sort of information per paragraph ratio, and he can get more different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so many excerpts chapter. I could have added into there, but I just couldn't put it all, because it would have been like 10 minutes long anyway. Or I could have just done the whole actual chapter reread, but that's just too long.
Exactly. But I mean, you are right, Sarah, as far as like we should give him a break, because Brienne's at the start of a book and this is the culmination. Nonetheless, it's very different in its pacing.
It is incredibly different pacing. Like Brienne's chapters are very meandering and wandering, and I think I like that because it's a nice breather. If you had fast-paced chapters, it would be a nice breather between them, but because in Feast for Crows a lot of them aren't really very like short, powerful chapters like this one, so you don't necessarily need a breather, and it's like, but can't I get like another Tyrion chapter like this?
I almost feel like it didn't even need to have so many reveals in one book, because you must have known while writing this is just so much amazing stuff, but you've also got plans ready for Feast and Dance that it's just spoiled the fans so quickly. And you could have had one giant reveal or something else along those lines of another wedding, probably not another wedding, but one of the weddings, put that in Feast, as long as you can get the timing correct. And wishful thinking though.
With you guys, this is the chapter I always think of as being the last chapter in A Storm of Swords, even though it's not, and there's like an extra about 100 after it. Well, yeah, about 100 pages after it. This is the one I always think of as being the final chapter because it just sticks with me so much. How about you guys?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Because like John has a chapter, Sam has a chapter, Sansa's got one, there's the epilogue. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, but...
I guess he wanted to end maybe on a bit of a happier note, so because this is so dark and miserable, even though it's the perfect curtain call
for that relationship.
I mean, I guess
the tone is dark
for Tyrion. It is, yeah. I mean, I was happy when Tywin got it. I was finally like, yes, the villain of the whole first three books is done. Finally, he's been defeated. But for Tyrion, it's so miserable. It's like he becomes numb throughout this. You just see his soul being shattered just throughout this whole, like it's so heartbreaking when he finds Jaime again and you get this spark of light, and you, because you know Jaime's like the one person in his family who's loved him and shown him support, and you get that immediate like back and forth and that brotherly kind of familiarity where they're cracking jokes with each other and just, you know, pointing out each other's maimings that they've received throughout the war and all that. And it's like, oh, finally some lightness to you think maybe Tyrion's going to be okay despite all the heartache he suffered throughout the trial. But then for Jaime to reveal this thing, like the ultimate, it's so much worse coming from the person who loved him than from anyone else, from Cersei or Tywin. And he's like, he burns his final bridge, like he burns his last vestige to humanity, and he says, yes, I killed your wretched son and I'll do it again. Like he wants to hurt Jaime in that moment, and he threatens to wreak revenge on him when they meet again. It's like, and there's a good line where Varys says, your path is down, and Tyrion's like, yes, I know, and this is the beginning of the end.
Down into darkness. He descends.
Yeah. It's great imagery. It's so gothic. It's like just these narrow corridors and these winding staircases and just pitch blackness. And when Varys is saying, like, you know, you don't want me to light a torch. You don't want to see what's down here. It's so darkly internal and miserable and horrible. Yeah, it's perfect sort of locational imagery to reflect what Tyrion's going through psychologically.
Which is perfect, though.
It really reminded me of, is it Walpole's Count of Otranto, that sort of original Gothic novel where they're running through a warren of corridors underneath the main aristocratic house.
Mm.
It's very similar. It's very much back to the roots of Gothic horror.
Yeah, and the sort of the trap doors and the eyes through the Absolutely. Through the paintings. Except now Tyrion is the monster coming out of the trap door. Like he was the one that was always paranoid about who was watching him and the little birds in the walls, but now he's the one skulking around. And even the language that he uses to describe himself just has this air of corruption about himself, where he's like, he speaks to Jaime in poisonous tones, and he's so aware of how horrible he looks or how horrible the way the world sees him, and he can hear his breath coming out of his mangled nose, and he stares up at Jaime with mismatched eyes. Like he's so aware of that kind of haptic sort of ruin that is his body. He sees himself as a monster, and now he's sort of rising out of the floorboards to slay this, to choke this woman to death and slay his father, and then vanish into the night again. He's become the monster that the world continually insists he was.
And that's
like,
why
you call him a monster long enough, he put him in a cage that. And he becomes a monster.
You see, that's why, like, I didn't have that feeling of victory when Tywin was killed. I was like, oh no, Tyrion now, who had been hitherto one of my favorite characters, has just become as bad as everyone else. He's become as corrupt, and especially when he kills Shay. And I mean, I couldn't have predicted just how dark he'd become in Dance, but it did not feel like a moment of any kind of triumph to me, for the reasons you've just suggested.
So who thinks Varys kind of set Tyrion up for this?
I was just about to say that.
Yeah, there's no doubt whatsoever.
Yeah, he seems to protest too much.
He doesn't. He's just like, no, you shouldn't go up. But if you are going to go up, go this way. But you shouldn't go. But do this.
Something I noticed on this reread was Varys has a brazier lit. So the whole place they're going through is dark. But this is an illuminated area. And that's what allows Tyrion to see the dragon mosaic. So, yeah, this has pushed me into Varys knew what he was doing.
You mean in Tywin's room?
No, so when they're going through the dungeons, there's a brazier in the room with a dragon mosaic that allows Tyrion to look down. Then he looks up the ladder and he goes, "We're under the Tower of the Hand, aren't we?" And Varys is like, "Yes, but we must keep going."
And yeah, and some people have pointed out there was like a chest neatly placed next to the crossbow. I don't think it would be that planned to me. It seemed like Jaime had forced this. Yeah, but it seemed like Jaime had forced this escape, like against Varys as well, which makes me suspect. Like, I think Tyrion was the one that legitimately broached it, and then Varys was sort of working through the ramifications and like, no, this wasn't part of the plan. But hey, he's offering to do it. Maybe I should nudge him towards that end. It's gonna help, you know, Aegon if Tywin is defeated and Cersei's in charge. So maybe he decided then and there. But I don't think it was part of a master plan. I think he just saw the opportunity and took it. But it probably would have upset his plans a lot, because Varys pretty much had to flee the city after that, which I doubt was his original intention.
Varys goes along with it, because we learn in A Feast for Crows that Jaime, he puts a knife to Varys's throat and says, "You're going to help me get Tyrion out." And Varys agrees. And a consequence of that is obviously he has to flee the city, or does he? But yeah, I sort of think he was planning to leave sooner or later, because the news about dragons is going to come in. And if he really wanted to, he could have just gone to Tywin and said, "Jaime wants to bust Tyrion out, by the way." So this definitely seems like it was in Varys' interests to do.
It's probably as good a time as any to set things in motion, or just kind of kick the Lannister dynasty over and watch them scramble.
Yeah, it's hard not to think that it was deliberately led there, because knowing in retrospect of the epilogue of Dance that Kevin actually keeping the... Well, the starting to get the kingdom in check. And there's also a part where... Or at least a theory that I've heard that Oberyn has actually poisoned Tywin, as well, as to why he's on the privy for so long, and whether or not that's made to look like it was Varys doing that, or it was actually Varys that had poisoned Tywin to make it look like that Oberyn had done it.
Right.
Possibly weakened Tywin.
Yeah, I've heard that as well, and it's also in book 4, like the descriptions of Tywin's corpse is having this strange smell and his joints getting all bloated and having this hideous smile across his face. Some people suspect he was like poisoned before he died, which I like the idea that it's almost like Murder on the Orient Express, like a bunch of people were planning to kill Tywin that night, and like one person poisoned him and one person shot him with a crossbow and one person came by and stabbed him afterwards, and it's like you can't even tell who killed him because everyone wanted to kill him.
He's made too many enemies.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, because obviously that was the main he was the main target of the Dornish hatred of the Lannisters for what happened. I mean, obviously, you know, Gregor did the deed, but they strongly suspected Tywin gave the order, so it wouldn't surprise me if he poisoned him. I don't know. Yeah. Because I would have thought he would have killed Greg first and try and get the truth out of Gregor, which is what he was doing during the trial. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he was like slowly doing it. Sorry, Ben.
I just wanted to say, is it worth spending a few moments just talking about the character arc of Tyrion in A Storm of Swords? I mean, this has been an epic book for him.
I think it's a lot of it has to do with Tysha. It's just this kind of unresolved trauma that's haunted Tyrion his whole life. It's completely poisoned his relationship with women and with people in general. I think he can't get close to someone because he suspects they could never love him. And to realize that the only person you thought loved you, Jaime, had betrayed you in this horrible way, and the person you thought had betrayed you the most, Tysha, had been the only person to love you. It's completely rocked the foundations of his whole, like, you know, psychological makeup. It's sort of this devastating blow. And it did generally seem to be traumatic, because it seemed like his memories of the event had been distorted. Once Jaime tells him what really happened, he realizes this was a gang rape and I'd participated in it. And that seems to hit him like a freight train all at once. And it's always been like eating at him, and this was the culmination of that. And it seems like he knew subconsciously that there was like a genuine love with Taisha, because I think it's at the end of book two where he's recovering from the Battle of Blackwater and he has this dream of the honeymoon of him and Taisha, and it's like really loving and beautiful and sweet, and there doesn't seem to be any anything duplicit about us at all. But as soon as he wakes up, he says, you know, curse her, she only wanted you for your money. And so I don't really have a well-formed thought, but it just seems to be the Taisha thing has always been eating at Tyrion, and this is kind of the culmination of that, and it will be the thing that continues to haunt him in book five, where he keeps asking everyone, where do horse go? It's like he wants to, I don't know, reach out to her and apologize to her or get him to forgive her, but it's never going to happen. It's
expiate, a bit like, yeah, and he can't
apologize.
It's a bit
like Brienne's, yeah, it's a bit like Brienne's quest for Sansa. It's a doomed quest. She's never actually going to reach her. The real quest is for him to forgive himself or find some kind of atonement for himself.
Yeah.
I dropped out when we were mentioning Oberyn poisoning Tywin. What was the consensus there?
I mean, he might have, but it doesn't really matter because they're both dead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I am a strong disbeliever of this theory for a number of reasons, but I just don't find it thematically satisfying for Oberyn's character if in the end it turns out he had poisoned Tywin. And also killing Tywin was Tyrion's act.
Yeah. Plus, as well, Oberyn was being very above board with how he was going about getting vengeance for his sister, to undercut that by just poisoning Tywin.
Yeah. He seemed to want a public declaration of guilt.
Yeah.
It's also just not thematically satisfying. If anyone was going to kill Tywin, it needed to be Tyrion for all those ongoing slights. It's the most satisfying resolution.
Yeah. Does anybody else think that it is incredibly hypocritical that Tywin is sleeping with Shay after being so against whores and very publicly against whores and demeaning Tyrion so much for having a whore and marrying someone and everything that he's done to Tyrion?
I think it's really poor writing, actually. I think George makes that decision in order to allow Tyrion to very quickly kill these two people who have betrayed him. But I just don't think it fits Tywin's character at all.
Oh, really? I think this is the ultimate undoing of Tywin, because I think he is a hypocrite and I think he's been whoring all his life.
Oh, I don't. I don't at all. Because he's so hates.
How long has it been since Jenna died?
Yeah, since Jenna died.
I think he's so trapped in the concept of hating his father, who was weak and weakened House Lannister. And everything is about House Lannister and the honor of that house. And I just don't think he would have been doing that.
A man has needs. And he probably would have hated himself afterwards.
He hated himself so much afterwards, and then he projected that onto Tyrion whenever he found out about Tyrion having
that's
a
whore. That's the way I saw it.
Oh, okay, yeah, the projection does make sense. I still don't see
it. He would have realised that, yeah, Tyrion is his son in every sense of the word.
I don't quite understand why is where he'd do it with Shay in particular, who's already been with Tyrion. Unless he's going to actually inform Tyrion of this, there's no logical sense as to why he'd be doing this anyway, regardless of whether it's a whore or not. It just strikes me as really odd.
So you want to hear my theory on why Shay ended up in Tywin's bed that night?
Please do, because I just don't buy it.
Okay. All right. So we learn in a later Cersei chapter in A Feast of Crows that this very day, or the day before this night, Shay goes to Cersei and says, all right, I said all the things at the trial. Can you pay up, please? Give me all the things you promised. And Cersei says, hey, no, you didn't tell me where Sansa is. You have to tell me where Sansa is or I'm not giving you anything. So Shay gets kicked out of Cersei's room and she's like, shit, I'm out on the streets. You know, I've got nothing left. What do I do? And then she has a light bulb appear above her head and she goes, I know, I'll do what I did last time. I'll go fuck the Hand of the King. And so she makes a beeline to Tywin's chambers, says, I have some very important information for Tywin to hear. And then once he's in the chambers, she just basically throws herself at Tywin. And Tywin, with his whoring ways, goes, oh, whatever, let's just do this and get it over with. And that's how he ended up together. What do you think?
Yeah. I think deep down, like for all the austere sort of respectable figure that Tywin tries to cut in the world to account for the weakness of his father, I think there's something really twisted about who he is as a person. Like the implication of why he ordered Gregor to do what he did to Elia and the children, because they somehow insulted the Lannister name by Rhaegar choosing them over Cersei. I think he's definitely a hypocrite. And you see that with Cersei, like him making her marry again when he never married again. It's like, do as I say, not as I do. And he, I definitely think, yeah, he hated his father, or he wanted to not be weak like his father, but he had weaknesses like whoring potentially, and he hated himself for that. And as you say, Sarah, I think that's probably projected onto Tyrion. But I also think like Tyrion is the object of his hatred, but he also sees a lot of himself in Tyrion, more so than Jaime and Cersei. So he sees the
weakness.
Which
will be ironic if he's not really a Lannister.
No, of that's course. Not well, true. It's not true.
Don't Lannister. Go to Tyrion,
well, that's the thing. That's why, and I know it's not a, I know it's not a popular theory, but Tyrion being the Mad King's son, I think that actually makes sense why he would bed Shay, because Shay belonged to Tyrion and Joanna belonged to him. So I think it's almost like he's in a sick sexual competition with Tyrion because he feels like cuckolded by the Mad King. Like, I think it's that twist. Yeah.
See, in my mind, Tywin was just going to kill Shay after he'd had sex with her. Like, morning comes, kill Shay, done.
I don't know, no, because he knew it was Tyrion. Like, he could have had anyone he wanted. He could have had any whore he wanted. Why does he want Shay? Because he's in a weird competition with Tyrion. It's sick.
Well, going back to my theory, Shay just put herself in the room and threw her at Tywin. Tywin might have been feeling horny and would have been like, I need to get off now. Let's just do it.
I think Martin is.
I'm not hearing a lot of support for this.
Yeah, it's going to be more thoughtful than that, but I don't
know. I think that makes sense why they would meet up again if she was rejected by Cersei. Maybe she went after Tywin. And
yeah, I feel that we're meant to think of Tywin as a hypocrite. That's basically his defining feature, really, because that's why George ends the chapter with Tywin Lannister in the end did not shed gold. Like, yeah, it's
everyone
great.
Said.
And he is, his sort of reputation is deeply tarnished by the way he's found, the fact that there's a dead prostitute in his bed and that he was on the toilet, like this great
and he pooped
figure,
himself,
died,
how embarrassing.
Died, you know, yeah, exactly,
right.
Died with his pants down. And the fact that he's like, he was always hated smiling and mistrusted laughter and all that, and his final image that everyone sees of him is him just grinning like a maniac as he's entombed. It's just a complete, yeah, just...
Oh yeah, the author's definitely exacting some revenge, right?
Everything, yeah. It's this, yeah, like almost sadistic spoiling of everything Tywin tried to be.
Just ultimate contradiction on his life.
Who do you think of as the best player of the game? If you had like a... Who's the most tactically intelligent of Tywin, Varys, Doran? Who else who else are the people that think of themselves as in that role?
Littlefinger.
Yep.
Olenna Tyrell, but potentially.
The thing about Littlefinger is he's never in a position of power where he has like a target painted on his back, whereas Tywin actually is the Hand of the King. He has the official title. So it's much harder for Tywin to play the game than someone like Littlefinger, who can sort of work behind the shadows and not be thought of as a danger and targeted.
Any genuine influence over anyone in that case. That's why I think Littlefinger has... probably got a little bit more up in Tywin in that respect, because he's been able to do all this from nothing and still have influence, where Tywin at least has a name and he's been able to put himself in a position of power where he can actually enforce what his or what he wants his family to be honest. And at least Littlefinger as well, he's had a lot of things come to fruition in comparison to Varys, where think up a lot on the fly, because just a lot of things just don't happen. I mean, him in cahoots with Illyrio and Dany staying in Meereen as well, that's just one giant thing that just did not seem to go well, and then he's just constantly having to change his plans. So Tywin is perceived a bit more than actually what he... Well, he's perceived, I suppose, where I do give a lot of credit to Littlefinger for what he's been able to do.
Yeah, he did it from scratch, which is impressive. And you're right, like Varys, he almost thinks too far into the future, where if one thing goes wrong, like, you know, Khal Drogo dying, it sort of upsets everything and he has to start again from scratch. Whereas Littlefinger seems to be able to adapt more easily and have a few sort of irons in the fire at any one time and pivot when he needs to.
Are there any other players that you consider on the level of Varys, Littlefinger, or Tywin, or you think it's just limited really to them, not necessarily within their own thought process?
Maybe Euron when we figure out what he's up to in terms of power. But
I'd say
I class
Queen of
him as...
I think
he's too magical. Like, he's not political so much as he's metaphysical, if that makes sense.
I mean, maybe Olenna Tyrell.
Yeah, I was going to say Queen of Thorns.
I think Melisandre's had a lot of impact on her circle of people within Stannis's camp. Not necessarily on anyone else, but with the people she's trying to influence, she has been very successful.
Again, I wonder if she falls into that sort of metaphysical category, though. Because it's not classic wheeler-dealer politics as we understand it, is it?
It's a bit of a cheat. It's magic. Yeah, it's like you can see three chess moves ahead with a like video replay, and you can produce chess pieces from nowhere. It's not like she's not playing by the rules.
No, indeed.
She makes her own rules. Come on.
She has shadow pawns and things.
Okay, anything else on the chapter?
The sort of, we get the mantras for Tyrion and Jaime in this chapter. We get where do whores go, which is what Tyrion keeps repeating over and over again in book 5, and Jaime gets told that Cersei is fucking, you know, Osni Kettle Black and Moonboy for all, and which is something he keeps internally repeating over and over again, and it's a big part of their transformation. Tyrion is a sort of a downward transformation, or he's seeking something he'll never find. But Jaime, I guess it's a kind of realization that the love he feels for Cersei isn't really reciprocated, and it's part of, I guess, his journey of separating himself from Cersei and becoming his own man.
Absolutely. It always reminds me, if anyone's read F. Scott Fitzgerald, Tender as the Night, there's a moment where Dick Diver, the protagonist, gets obsessed with the girl that he's having an affair with, having an affair on him, and he has another one of those mantras that he keeps repeating. It's a great line.
I liked the bit of discovering the tunnels underneath the castle and the observation chambers. It felt like sort of the veil was being lifted, because we've often wondered, how does Varys know all this information? And now we basically understand how his little birds work. He sends children through the little chimney chutes and stuff.
I mean, actually, to a certain extent, Tywin being killed and therefore Jaime and everyone else investigating those tunnels is a bit of a... Isn't that a shame for Varys? Because suddenly all his...
Yeah, he's given away his hand.
He's given away his hand. Yeah. So to a certain extent, although he's kind of manipulated Tyrion into committing the murder, he has lost out from it. But maybe he just thinks, well, I'm leaving Westeros anyway, so the utility of these tunnels is done.
Yeah, I don't think he needs it anymore. It's served its purpose.
Yeah. There is a line in A Feast for Crows, as they're exploring them, that they map out the Tower of the Hand, but then Cersei's stupid and burns it down. But two other guards who went searching, they just vanished and never turned up again. So I think some of the tunnels have been compromised, but not the whole sort of Red Keep area. Because obviously we see him assassinate Kevin with ease.
True that.
I know we talked a bit about Cersei's chapters being frustrating in book 4, but another thing I loved was this like paranoia that she has, that Tyrion's still lurking around somewhere in the tunnels and watching her at night, and she keeps trying to flush them out and burn them and find him. It's almost like that kind of the rats in the wall kind of paranoia, and he starts seeping into her dreams.
Paranoia is so much fun though, reading.
It's so creepy and gothic. I love it.
Just for that.
Yeah.
Just a descent into madness.
Yeah, in fact, we get a Cersei chapter in the next episode of the reread, and it literally opens with her having a nightmare about Tyrion laughing at her and her maid waking her up from it. So it's going to be a pervasive theme. It's such a great chapter.
And she gets everything coming from all angles, like, as well as thinking that Tyrion's still in the tunnels. You've got, soon later on, you've got the Faith that will eventually come into play. And also, I think they find a coin a bit later on that makes her lead to believe that it's the Tyrells as well.
Mm-hmm.
So just to add to the paranoia throughout her entire feast arc.
I mean, just because she's paranoid doesn't mean she's not partly right. I mean, there are great forces massing against her.
Yeah.
A broken clock hit is right twice a day.
Indeedy. Okay, so thank you very much for listening, guys, and participating, hosts. For those following along at home, the next episode of The Reread will be hosted by Nadia, a special request from her, because she is such a Sansa fan. It's going to cover... just lost my notes. It's another 3-book chapter. It's going to cover Cersei 1 from A Feast for Crows, Quentin 1 from Dance with Dragons, who is still at this point alive, and Sansa 7, which is the death of Lysa chapter from A Storm of Swords. So those events take place over 3 days, but were published 11 years apart, which always gives me sort of a little thrill to realise that we're doing stuff that's so far apart. If you want to follow us on at home, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave. If you want to hear stuff a little bit ahead of when it's out on YouTube, do check the WordPress page. And to get involved or to sort of get in the discussion, search for a podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums. So with that, thank you very much, my co-hosts. Do any of you have any forthcoming episodes you'd like to pimp out?
Episode 64 of the reread.
In which we'll be discussing stuff like, you know, the rise of the Tyrrells, all the sort of non-Rob related big themes in Storm of Swords, right?
Yes, nice. That's the plan so far anyway. And if you have any questions that you'd like answered or themes that you'd like to be discussed, please let us know because we're looking for things to cover. Thank you.
We're planning another video game roundtable, which we're recording next weekend. So it's kind of like you just pick your top three favorite games and we just sort of go around the group and chat about them. And yeah, nice. It's just a good way to get some good suggestions for video games.
Well, thank you everyone for joining. Thank you to Michael, Duncan, Lee, Sarah and Dana, who sadly had to leave a bit earlier. Thanks for listening, everyone. And yeah, let us know what you want discussed on episode 64. That's the biggie. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
How was your first podcast?
Oh, thoroughly enjoyed it, to be honest. It's exactly as I expected. Good.
Complete chaos.
It wasn't as chaotic as I genuinely was led to believe by everyone that I've spoken to about it.
This one wasn't chaotic.
Yeah, rereads have a bit more of a set way of going about things, maybe. Yeah, okay, cool.
I just made sure that I did my chapter justice, which I feel like I did all right.
So, no, I think you were very good. I hope to see you on a new reread in future or other episodes.
Yeah, the doozy as well to get Tyrion, 13 as your first chapter to read.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I
throw myself in deep end quite happily as well. I've got so many notes that I just wrote down because I just wanted to be as prepared as I could. Even though I didn't really speak as much as I could have, I still feel like that I've got plenty of points across. I mean, I've even still got like a whole ton of just like little bits and pieces that I couldn't really find relevant to what was said in there. But
yeah, it's tricky. You sort of got to go with the flow of the conversation.
Yeah.
No, you did very well for the first episode. I think you got lots of stuff across. Yeah.
Cool. I just wanted to make sure it's clear, because I'll just quickly say a couple of things. Like one was just about I felt like that Tywin is like the Game of Thrones version of Vince McMahon. Just looks powerful, but is just really crumbling underneath the scenes.
I agree.
And that Miranda was, I think she's genuinely a bigger threat than Shadrach in Winds and for Sansa, because I obviously of her jealousy, but I feel like she's also a spy for the other lords.
Yes.
Just really to see what's going on with Sansa and Tyrion in particular, Littlefinger in particular, because I feel like that they just don't have a proper grasp on Littlefinger despite the impending tournament there. But it's that I find really fascinating, more so than the point of Shadrach being there, just more as like an impending cliffhanger. I see.
I think he'll be the unmasking of Sansa. His cliffhanger will lead to her having and Littlefinger having to deal with the fact that the cat's out of the bag, and that's a situation they have to deal with.
Mm. Yeah, I can definitely see that.
And that's probably when Miranda will come into play, because yeah, I think she's definitely the smartest person we've met in the Vale so far.
Yeah, because it feels like also that her and Sansa are almost becoming genuine friends too, but yes. Whether or not that's just a giant act that's been put on, which seems to have worked very well, that's the biggest watch this space for the Elaine chapters for me.
It would be nice if Sansa had some genuine friends to
have. Just one.
Just one, please.
Yeah.
I mean, Marjorie was okay, like, but she was obviously had her own loyalties.
I feel so bad for Sansa because at that age, you really do want to have friends around you. It's to be able to talk to them. And then she doesn't, and she knows that she can't really tell anyone about anything that's happened to her. And it's like, poor girl.
I do find that's actually quite nice about Sansa's arc is that Jane Poole, who's reasonably similar circumstance as Miranda, who she just completely shunned off when at that age. But now Miranda, I'd imagine if that was Jane Poole now, she'd actually give Jane Poole the time, the time of day. Or if Miranda was the same birth, obviously a situation is a bit different, but I don't feel like she would have given Miranda the time of day back when she would have started. So I think that is a nice part to come out of Sansa's arc as well, is just her development in dealing with people. And she's learned a lot from Littlefinger too in that respect.
Yeah, I agree.
That's funny, because I think she's going to meet up with Jane Poole in The Winds of Winter, and they're going to reconnect, and that will be the catalyst for Littlefinger's downfall. Because I think they'll be, Sansa will be like, oh my god, Jane, what happened to you? And then she'll be like, oh, Littlefinger sent me to a brothel and then sold me to the Boltons. And Sansa will be like, he did what? So yeah, that's my theory. They're gonna get back together.
I reckon it'll be the Ned Stark thing, that he betrayed Ned Stark. But I don't know who would reveal that. The Hound. Anyway.
Cool. Well, happy rest of the evening, everybody. I'm not going to go and have
some. Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, sure. One thing I didn't actually, I've got written down in front of me, was a part of the questions that about the theories part, is that there's a couple of quick ones. One is that Tyrion will have his tongue cut out in the future, which I with Jaime having his hand gone, what he prides the most.
Oh, Cersei. No.
I really do think it's going to happen. And my favorite actual theory is not necessarily one that I agree with, but it's Scott or Shaggy Dog's conviction of the R plus L equals D theory. He does make great points, but I just think it's just too far-fetched. Like, the undying commitment when someone challenges it. It's great to hear.
I applaud his dedication. Yes. I can't agree with any of it, but yeah.
That's not patronizing at all. But I completely agree.
I didn't mention it, but we also get another confirmation that Dany was widely believed to be born on Dragonstone in this chapter. Like one of the rationales of R plus L equals D that varies, like tricks Dany into thinking she was born on Dragonstone when she was actually born somewhere else. But it's actually like widely believed all the way to Old Town that she was born on Dragonstone, which implies that there was quite a few people present to witness her birth. It's not confirmation, it's just a little dig in that theory.
Sense.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like.
A consensus. There's a wide consensus. It's not this little trick that only one or two people could have been privy to. It's widely believed that she was born on Dragonstone. Anyway.
And then Lee, what's the final theory?
I think that Dany will be the one to actually take down the Citadel, not Euron, because Dany is known as the breaker of chains, and the maces all wear chains just like a sigil. I can't remember where I saw that, but it really hit me, and I thought it made sense. It doesn't make sense why she'd go there, at least in the short term of Winds, but...
It does if she finds out that they're planning on killing her dragons.
Or just to confront Euron. Because Euron, I think, will set his power base in Old Town, and the two of those have to face off.
And didn't Aegon the Conqueror threaten to burn down, was it the Hightower or the Citadel? One of the two, before they surrendered.
Yeah,
like
right.
Old Town surrendered in order to protect the... So like maybe she'll come back and fulfill that threat 300 years later.
Which could be kind of cool.
Mm.
Especially because it's the sigil is literally a tower with a fire on top of it.
Yep.
And you'll just be like, well, you had it coming. You had to
it's
know
really
it's
tempting
gonna happen.
Fate.
Cool. Well, my breakfast calls. Have a great evening, everybody.
All right.
Have a good morning, Bina.
Bye, Bina. Have a nice day.
Bye.
Come on, you Spurs, Bina. Bye. 4 o'clock in the morning for me. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Bye.
See you guys.
Oh, and Christy also says hello. And who won the Ashes again? That's from her, not me.
Yeah. Wow. Fighting talk, Christy. Fighting talk.
Destroying British-Australian relations.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
Okay.
Evelyn is never going to do one of these ever again.
Nah, I love Australia. It's just every time I come there, like, England gets spanked at the cricket.
Then you need to come and not for cricket. You need to come and be a tourist.
It's just a long way to come if there's no cricket. Like, I'm not saying your country isn't amazing, but it's a long flight if there's no cricket.
It's only worth it for the cricket.
Yeah, basically. Oh, dear. On that slightly insulting note, I'll close out the call. Goodbye, everyone.